Hi, everybody. My name is Gary Sassman. I'm the Director of Print and Digital Media for Comic-Con, and it's my pleasure to be here today to introduce one of our special guests, Christopher James Priest. A long career in comics that includes Quantum and Woody. He's probably best known for his run on Black Panther at Marvel. Player in the Batman universe with the sequence that ended up being part of the Christopher Nolan film. So, but it's also my honor to be here today to recognize Christopher's career and give him our Inkpop Award for Achievement in Comic Arts.
Oh! Whoa!
Yeah!
Good stuff!
Is that a pretty one? Hold on. Is that for me right here? Stand one by yourself? By yourself? Looking at me. You're good, thank you.
I've never won anything.
Perfect.
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to leave this here.
Yeah.
Hello. Hello. Are we on? Hello. Hello. Oh, now it's on. Hello. Hey, there we go. Hi, I'm Christopher Priest. I'm older than you. I'm blacker than you. Here now. Here now the news. I have a presentation that you won't see because the bulb broke. And I don't have the right adapter for the computer. But if you come by my hotel room, I'll be glad to run it for you. to tell my own story, so far as I know, I'm the first African American editor at Marvel Comics. In 1978, I was hired as an intern, and I started professionally in 1979 as Larry Hama's assistant on a magazine called Crazy Magazine. And then in 1990, I became the first African American editor at DC Comics, where I was producing such memorable things as Spelljammer and these TSR role-playing books and so forth. Oh, yeah, we got a fan there. Okay. Over the years, I've written everything. I've written series for Marvel for quite a while. I was on staff at Marvel for quite a while, and then I was a writer. And then I took some time off, and then I went to D.C., and I did a bunch of writing for D.C. At some point in my career, I've written, you name it, just about everything. But I started with the Falcon miniseries, and then we went to Power Man and Iron Fist, which I wrote for quite a while. Conan the Barbarian. Thank you for that. I know I'm forgetting all kinds of stuff. And then over to Marvel, Spider-Man, of course. I did a bunch of Spider-Man writing. Spider-Man versus Wolverine, which sold amazingly well, and they never asked us to do it again. I don't know what that was about, but yeah, it did a really good job there. Oh, I signed a bunch of those today. That made me really happy. Then at DC, I co-created a character called The Ray. Discovered a scrawny guy sitting in the lobby who came to work for me drawing Spelljammer, of all things, after my artist quit. I had the guy in the office, and he left, and then my Spelljammer artist quit because over something. He wanted, I don't know, a bigger dressing room or a larger trailer or something. And I said, well, I can't do that for you. He said, well, I quit. He said, okay. And I turned around and I said, is that kid still out there in the lobby? And he goes, oh, yeah, he's still out. So I run out in the lobby, and I saw this kid, and I said, oh, look, here's a script. Bring this back to me in a week. If you can do that, you've got a job. I'm going to hire you for Spelljammer. And he certainly did, and that kid's name was Joe Quesada. And now he's, like, huge, you know, and so forth. Over the years, I've helped a bunch of people get started. I'm not going to take credit for them because their talent is what made them great. Most of them are not speaking to me anymore, but these are people that I worked with for the first time and whose work I helped introduce for the first time. Among them, Peter David, Mark Silvestri, Kyle Baker, Mark Beecham, good grief, and the list goes on. Joe Quesada, obviously, really fresh, talented guys. When I was at Marvel, I always felt that it was important to bring in new talent and to open doors for people, because I was very grateful that Jim Shooter opened the door for me. A lot of times in this business, what happens is we kind of replicate ourselves. We hire people that have qualities or things that remind us of ourselves. And that's when the business becomes very incestuous, because it's like you're only having kids with, you know, with your sister or something. And, you know, they're all kind of, you know, they're turning left. They got their left signal on all the time when they're driving. So I was always looking for someone who was not like me. And let's see what they can do, and let's you know, give them a shot at something. And that's basically what I was doing a lot of times. So I did a lot of development work and worked with a lot of new talent that now are way more powerful than I am. So that's very great that that's taken over. But basically, yeah, I've just been around forever. I've been in the business for about 38 years. In the last, I don't know, 8 or 9 years or so, a couple things happened. I was writing a book called The Crew, which was canceled before issue 1 came out, because Marvel decided to put The Crew, package it. Oh, there you go. Thank you. Marvel decided to package The Crew with a line of comics that they were launching, and the line was based on some idea, and I don't remember what it was. But The Crew had absolutely nothing to do with that line. We just happened to come out that month. But the line was not well received, and they did an across-the-board cut, and we got cut. And that, you know, before your first issue comes out, that hurts. So they made me feel better because they gave me a book called Captain America and the Falcon. And I went, okay. So we did Captain America and the Falcon for about a year or so, and there was the regular Captain America book was at Marvel Knights. And when the Marvel Knights Captain America ended, I thought, well, okay, they're going to bring Captain America back into the Marvel Universe, and we'll get that. Joe Bennett, the artist, and I, we will get that shot. And what they decided to do is they brought Captain America in, and they hired a young man named Ed Brubaker? Yeah, Ed Brubaker, who I did not know. I don't know him now, and he's a great writer, and I'm very happy for him. But that was my book, damn it! So the thought was, we're going to take Captain America out of your book and relaunch it as the Falcon, because we really like what you're doing with the Falcon. But for me, as a person of color and as someone who started in this business as a writer and somehow, I don't know how, over the years became a black writer, there were variables in that decision that I don't think editorial was aware of. I'm not saying it was a racist choice, or I think it was a smart choice for their marketing and so forth, but I don't think anyone there really understood that it felt like a demotion to me. And it was a very demoralizing decision. So at the same time, a friend of mine, Paul Kupperberg, who was an editor at DC Comics, he offered me a series of novels based on Green Lantern. I wrote the outlines for two of them, but I actually did the prose work, the hands-on work for one of them, and that kind of ruined me for comics, because it paid almost nothing. It, you know, prose work, unfortunately, doesn't pay nearly as well as comics do, but my God, it was freeing, because no one at DC, and I mean no one, cared about this novel. So I just went, okay, well, Batman shows up, and Aquaman shows up, and, you know, and then all these other different things happened, and I was just having a great time. And it's called Green Lantern Sleepers, and I wrote the third volume. And then someone licensed that, and there's actually, I call it an audiobook, but it's actually more like it's like a play. They actually have actors and sound effects, and they acted it out. It's a whole lot of fun, you know, so that's out there. But once I wrote the Green Lantern thing and I was kind of, you know, tired with the comic book thing, I started looking for other opportunities to write prose. I went into ministry. I'm an ordained a pastor in Colorado Springs, so I started pastoring a church and just doing things that were not really related to the business and kind of, you know, just out of the loop with things. Every 18 months or so, I'd get a call from Marvel or a call from DC, you know, from one of the majors or something, and it would be an editor, and he goes, "I got a great idea. We're bringing back all Negro comics, and we want you to write it." You know, or you know, we want you to do Black Goliath, or we want you to do Black Lightning. You can do it with the wig or without the wig, you know. It kind of was a challenge for me because I just went, well, when did I become a black writer? You know, a black writer. You know, I'm certainly proud of being an African American. I'm not embarrassed by it. But I built my career on Spider-Man, on Green Lantern, on things like that, Thor, Hulk. You know, I wrote all that stuff. When did I become only eligible to write black characters? So we'd have this discussion, and I go, "Well, no, I don't think so. But how about Martian Manhunter? I've got this great idea for Martian Manhunter. He's green, he's neutral. We could do Martian Manhunter." And, you know, and they go, "Eh." So we'd have this conversation where I'd want to do something that they didn't want to do, or they'd want me to do something that I didn't want to do, and then we'd go, "Okay, see you in 18 months." Finally, I got offered something from DC that I thought was really interesting. They offered me Firestorm. And I was like, "Okay, you mean the guy with his hair on fire? That guy? Yeah, okay, all right, barbecue hair, I could probably do something like that." And we started having productive discussions, the editor and I, about Firestorm. And things were going really well. And I was like, "Okay, I think this is something I could probably do. Send me everything you got on Firestorm, you know, and I'll take a look at it." So literally the next day or the day after, the FedEx truck pulls up and, you know, I get this box of Firestorm stuff. "Yes, thank you very much, yes." So I get the Firestorm package in the mail and I rip the thing open and I start flipping through this thing and he's black. What happened to Firestorm, you know? And I call the editor and says, "He's black?" And he goes, well, yeah, we thought you knew that." "Well, I don't read comics. I didn't know he was black." You know, and I said, "Okay, that's really not going to work either." And that was, I don't know, about 3 years ago or something. So, and then about, 5 months ago, I was minding my business, you know, doing my thing and so forth. And I get an email from a group editor at DC talking to me about Deathstroke. And it took me a while to remember who Deathstroke was, and I went, "Okay, so Deathstroke, he's the guy that fights the Teen Titans, the guy in the chainmail, okay, orange, half-blind, yeah, okay, he's a villain." And that was an interesting challenge for me, because I don't think I've ever been invited to write a villain before. I don't do villains very well, because I don't believe in villainy. I think we all have different points of view. I think, you know, the Joker has a... his point of view is just as valid as mine. He's just, you know, a homicidal maniac, you know. But so I never really did villains very well. And you'll be the judge of whether I'm doing one well now. But the Deathstroke thing kind of intrigued me. And I thought, okay, is he black? And they said, "No, but Wintergreen is black." And I said, "No, he's not." And they said, "Okay, well, we're doing this rebirth thing that is kind of an evolution or course correction or however you want to put it from the new 52. And I said, "Fine, what's the new 52? So they had to explain to me all this stuff, and I'm still kind of catching up. And, you know, and now I have some friends who did some, volunteered to do some research for me, and they said, they sent me these dossiers about what's been going on while you've been gone. While you were sleeping, this is what's been going on. And you know, and stuff across my desk, like the Batman is now Commissioner Gordon and a robot or something. And I thought, very funny. They're not really. So at any rate, we came to terms with Deathstroke. They sent me the new 52 stuff and whatever other reference. And I read it. And with all due respect to the writers, I don't mean to disparage anybody. I just said, well, I'm just really not interested in doing that. If I can do this other thing, go behind the mask, be introspective, get inside the mind of a killer, then that's something that I would probably be open to. And oddly enough, DC said yes. So I started pushing for a bunch of things. I got 90% of what I wanted. The other 10%, of course, DC is wrong. what we are doing is we are, I didn't recognize the character from the current series. My recollection of Deathstroke is the guy from Marv Wolfman, who was one of my very first bosses when I was an intern. I interned for him on Tomb of Dracula. And from George Perez, who we affectionately refer to as George Payrays at Marvel. And George is maybe the sweetest guy ever to walk the earth. And that's the character I remembered. So I said, well, I want to write that guy. Can I write that guy? And they said, sure. So what we've done is we've taken basically Marv and George's Deathstroke and kind of dragged him into 2016. We're doing some things and we're kind of taking him away from being this hulking Lobo sort of super soldier with all this armament, because he's an assassin. You know, assassins, they don't go jangling around with a bandolier and, you know, and all this weaponry. Assassins, assassins are very quiet. You know, that's part of the rule. You know, they cling to the shadow, they step out of the shadow, they slit your throat, and they vanish. And that's how I see Deathstroke. So I'm a little nervous, though I'm a lot nervous about what we're doing. And the presentation that I would have shown you here is at ChristopherPriest.com/Deathstroke. And you can see it for yourself and, you know, all that good stuff. So we're, you know, I think people who are familiar with my work will find some resonance in what we're doing in Deathstroke. There's some stuff that's just deliberate echoing of story structure and things from, say, Black Panther, where Deathstroke, I think his greatest power is his intellect. And I think too often that's been kind of underutilized or underemphasized, I should say. So we're actually making the book more intimate by moving away from the first-person narrative. So we're actually stepping back so that at any given point, the characters in Deathstroke's world are wondering what he's up to, what he's thinking, what his motive is, because you really don't know, and he's really ain't going to tell you. And I'm just trying to write him as Batman's equal in every sense of the word, intellectually, in terms of preparation, in terms of weaponry, tactics. He's loaded, so any toys he needs, he can get. And we will still dress him up with all the hardware when he's being dropped into a war zone or when it's actually appropriate. But, you know, if he's just kind of tiptoeing around to go whack a guy, he's not going to wear the hardware store on his back, you know, anymore, things like that. So for the first few months, I did everything I could to get them to fire me. I don't know that, you know, DC, there's like a ghost that lives at DC where, like, Marvel has always been, let's take chances, you know, and DC has always been like, you know, we have rules and regulations, we're part of Warner Brothers, there's paperwork, you know, that sort of thing. So there's just been a lot of times when I went, you know, I want Deathstroke to do something, and I get the word back, well, no, I want Deathstroke to kill that cat. Well, Deathstroke can't kill that cat. Like, well, why? Well, because, you know, he's never killed a cat before. Well, that's not a reason why, you know. You know, like for, you know, Ravager, the daughter, Rose Wilson. Why is she called Ravager? Well, she took the name because her brother Grant had that name. She didn't know Grant. Grant died when she was a kid. I don't even know if she knew Grant. So why does she have that name? What does that name mean? You know, Batman, who shows up in issue 5, one of his lines in the book, Rose is driving the Batmobile and they're having this conversation in the car, and she calls him Batman. He interrupts and says, that's not my name. My name's not Batman. That's what people call me for obvious reasons, but, you know, that's not my name. And then he looks at her and goes, what's your name? What do people call you? Why do they call you that? And that's me just kicking DC in the shin, going, we have to write this better because the audience is better, the times are better, they want better stuff, we don't want goofy stuff, we want people to be properly motivated. And, you know, and there's too many characters. So, I think I'm just driving some of the people insane, and they're going, why did we call this guy? Because every time we turn around, he's going, why? You know, well, why not? You know, well, why? You know, so I think people who are familiar with my work will like what we're doing, hopefully will like what we're doing. I'm very optimistic about that. People who are really into Deathstroke, this is going to be a bit of an adjustment. The main thing I'm struggling, but I've had to kind of negotiate with DC is that, and you should probably write this down somewhere, Deathstroke is a villain. I'm not really sure why, but I guess because his name is on the comic book, there's some expectation that at some point he's going to act heroically by accident, like a Clint Eastwood anti-hero. And sometimes they'll call him a mercenary, or he's a soldier of fortune, or he's whatever. He's a villain. He is a son of a bitch, and he is not a nice person and not a nice guy. So there was kind of this struggle, can I write this unlikable person? And on issue one, page one, there's a flashback of Slade and his kids, where Slade is being a complete and total dick to his kids, you know, and that's kind of the kind of character he is. I'm not saying he doesn't love his children. Of course he loves his children, but he's like the worst dad ever. He's very good at being an assassin. He's very bad at parenting and, you know, being a guy. What fascinates me about villains is, you know, a lot of times we paint them two-dimensionally because in storytelling you give your main character three dimensions and you give your supporting cast two dimensions, you know, you flesh them out a little less. So the villain has always suffered in some way. And the best villains are villains that we've taken the time to kind of explore who they are. And if this guy is going to be the front man for this book, if he's the protagonist and he's a villain, you know, then my question is why? Why is someone going to be like that? Why is he going to be like that? Why aren't the DC heroes, why isn't every person in spandex in the DC universe chasing this guy down 24/7? Because if we don't explain that, and that's what our first year is about, explaining that. If we don't explain that, then we don't have a book. Because now we're asking you guys to just suspend your disbelief that Superman goes home every day and he kisses Lois or whatever he does. You know, and he just allows this maniac to run around in the orange suit. So we're exploring the concept of villainy and the concept of justice and seeing how we almost can't have, you know, you can't have justice without having a guy like Deathstroke running around. And what I mean by that is you can be a vigilante and you can go lock Deathstroke up in Guantanamo Bay on no charges. You know, Superman could just kill him, right? Batman could just run around and kill him. But that's not justice. It could be heroism, but it's vigilanteism. Okay, justice means every now and then the bad guy gets away with it. Why? Because much like our friend O.J. Simpson, Deathstroke is really rich and he has a lot of lawyers. And the challenge with Deathstroke is one, he's really good at not leaving evidence or being caught on camera. And number two is they have never once been able to prove in a court of law that Deathstroke and Slade Wilson are one and the same, even though that's a fairly open secret in the superhero community. So that's what we're doing. We're exploring the whole issue of villainy, which in turn will explain like the concept of justice and explore the concept of justice by kind of deconstructing these things. So in issue 5, he's running into Batman, and Batman approaches his work in a very different way from Superman, who shows up in issue 8. But by putting him against these iconic characters and insisting, you know, that we do this and having to fight to get those characters to show up in the book, we're comparing, contrasting, and what we're doing is redefining or clarifying who Deathstroke is and why he does what he does. So in a lot of ways, what we're doing is kind of, I see Deathstroke as being kind of emotionally stunted, where he is addicted to the action, to the juice. This is just what he does. This is life work. He could give it up, but... No, actually, no, strike that. He really can't give it up. It's like an addiction to him. But he does love his kids. He's just, he can't hug them. You can hug him. You know, Wintergreen tells Rose, well, you can hug him, but he can never hug you. He's not going to initiate, you know, because he's emotionally, he's like house MD with a machine gun. You know, he's just that disjointed like that. And the series is kind of almost like The Sopranos with supervillains, where he's like this head of this dysfunctional family, and trying to make that work. You know, imagine your dad, you know, whose day job is he's a supervillain who runs around assassinating people. So I'm real excited about it. We're working with two art teams. One is Carlos Pagayan, Carlos Pagulayan. I knew I was going to do this. Somebody help me. The inker is, oh gosh, Jason. Ha. Jason, whose last name I can't remember right now. But the art is just amazing, because all of this is very, it's a character-driven book, and it all relies on these guys being able to pull off the characterization, the acting, and all that stuff. And Carlo and Jason, they're just doing just an amazing job. And the other art team is my old friend from the crew and from Captain America, Joe Bennett. And Mark Morales is the inker, and I cannot tell you just how, it's like a family reunion. We're just having so much fun with this. And we've divvied up aspects of Slade's life such that Carlo is kind of handling Slade's relationship with his ex-wife Adeline and Jericho, who will show up in issue 6, I think. And the other art team is mainly dealing with Slade and his dysfunctional relationship with Rose, who is a hoot to write. And I really hope that that the readers really enjoy what we're doing and don't burn my house down. So that's the pitch for Deathstroke. That's my little bit of history. This is my wonderful PowerPoint. They fixed the bulb, but they don't have the right connector for my computer, so we're out of luck here. What I want to do is just kind of open it up for questions and find out what you guys want to talk about. Anything I was going to show you there is on my website, which is ChristopherPriest.com. But if there's any questions, let's go for it. Sir?
Let's talk to you about Zero.
Uh-huh.
It's my favorite book that you wrote.
Wow, thank you. You're the one who won that. Okay.
Yep. Bought it twice. When it came out, just bought a set on eBay.
Okay, great.
What made you write that kind of a story would seem very risky for me for DC Comics? I still look at that book now and I can't believe it.
In fact, it's interesting you brought that up, because I had the same sort of, you know, push and pull relationship over Zero, which was still spelled with an X, X-E-R-O, that as I'm having with the Deathstroke. Now, Zero was a creator-owned book that Paul Levitz asked me to, do something outside the box. Paul Levitz, the former publisher of DC, came to me personally and said, I want you to create something new and different and so forth. And then he handed me off to the editors, and I guess he forgot to tell them. So there was a lot of... Now, the conceit of Zero, for those of you who've never read it, and most of you probably fit that category, is that what if Denzel Washington and Kevin Costner were in the same movie, but they were playing the same character? So he's like Charles Barkley in his private life. He's an NBA star, an angry NBA star, who runs around in this costume as an assassin of all things, or a covert operative called Zero. And part of the costume is a full face mask. So he, as Zero, he's a blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy in the costume. And in his private life, he's Charles Barkley. So you would never put the two of them together. And then there were a lot of controversial issues in the book and so forth. It was pretty edgy. And Chris Cross, beautiful, some of the most fabulous work that the guy's done. Truthfully, I invented that when I was 15 years old. I wrote that as a series of text or prose things, and back then we had something called carbon paper. You know, where you put like three pieces of typing paper and put the carbon paper between it, and that's how you made multiple copies. And I would sit here and I'd type up these adventures of this guy. He wasn't named Zero back then, Or was he? I don't remember. No, he was called Stingray back then. But I would write the stuff up, and then I would take it down the block to my little raggedy crew of ne'er-do-wells, and I'd pass it out, and we'd be sitting on the step reading the story. So the character Trent in the book, there's an actual Trent that was a friend of mine, and his brother was the guy that turned into Zero. And all the characters in the book were actually based on my childhood friends. So that's where that came from. Anybody else? Sir?
First off, I did a quick check. Is Joe Bennett?
Yes. Yeah, that was the name I was trying to remember. It was Jason's name. Go ahead.
Okay. So, Jeff starts a villain. How do you define what a villain is? What is a villain?
A villain is not just someone who operates outside the law, because Batman operates outside the law. You know, a villain is somebody who does bad things and has no conscience about it. At Deathstroke, you know, I think he's pretty much a sociopath, but I think he's almost a psychopath. But I think he experiences emotion, he just can't express it. But I think that he's a deeply wounded guy who needs to be on some sort of medication, you know. But he's a guy that does, I think villains are people who are consciously doing something evil. So DC has a whole, you know, rogues gallery of villains. I don't think all of them really qualify as villains. I would not classify the Joker even as a villain. I think he's psychotic, you know. But Slade, I don't think Slade is really mentally ill. I think he has made a decision about how he wants to live his life. And the way we're writing it is when he was in the Army, he wasn't Captain America, but he was darn close. He was a pretty decent guy. He was more like George Clooney in Three Kings, right? And then the experiment, he gets these powers like Captain America, he becomes Deathstroke, and he's doing some work for the government, and he's doing some freelance work. It's wet work, it's not pleasant, but it's not necessarily evil. But then his son is kidnapped. Deathstroke does some mission, and he assassinates some foreign guy, some foreign colonel. And the colonel's boss gets pissed off about it, and he sends assassins to kill Deathstroke. But instead of getting Deathstroke, they kidnap Deathstroke's son to lure him into some sort of trap. And the son ends up getting his throat cut. And that's where Deathstroke becomes Deathstroke. That's where he starts going off the edge. So in my, what we're calling it, kind of, not revised, but a sort of idealized, revisionist sort of history, he's gone through these stages where he was nearly heroic, then he was kind of baseline, you know, covert operative, but he didn't really become evil until his family started to fall apart. He lost his son, his wife divorced him, his wife shot him in the head and took his eye out. That'll make you kind of evil, I think, you know, that kind of thing. Sir?
So I know you said you didn't like being, like, handling the black characters and all that, but take full comfort in the fact that you left them better than when you found them, like, you know, in the cases of Steel and Black Panther, you know, like Wakanda was like so much more conventional when you were writing it than, like, you know, Kirby's original idea.
Well, you know, actually my approach to writing is that every version is valid. When I was writing Black Panther, I went out of my way to honor Don McGregor because I thought what he did was brilliant. I went out of my way to not invalidate anyone, including the Jack Kirby Black Panther, which was completely ridiculous. But I found, you know, I went, no, everything that happened. And we're taking that same attitude with Deathstroke. In terms of the black characters, you know, I have such respect for writers. You know, Louise Simonson, who used to be Louise Jones before she married Walt, you know, she is an incredibly wonderful, talented, smart woman, a good friend of mine. I love her so much, you know, that I would never go, well, mine is better. You know, because it all depends on whoever, you know. I just had a different take. With Steel, I was writing Dwayne McDuffie, the late writer and editor-in-chief of Milestone. I was writing him. I didn't tell Dennis, the artist, Dennis Cowan. I didn't tell him I was writing Dwayne. But he read the script and he was like, he's writing Dwayne. So I will draw Dwayne. So, you know, that's actually the way Dwayne looked. We scalped him, but he was drawing Dwayne. I was writing Dwayne as someone, you know, and I thought John Henry Irons was a guy who was incredibly intelligent, dropped into a world that wasn't his own. And, you know, he is this very, he's the only grown-up in the book and the only sane person in the book, dropped into this incredible environment with all these lunatics. And my niece Candace was the model for Natasha. And he's raising this, you know, obstreperous teenager and working with this nutty guy named Dr. Villain, of all people, who I am bringing back in Deathstroke. Amen. Thank you. but yeah, so, you know, with Luke Cage, there were staffers at Marvel that actually confronted me and said that, you know, I don't write black characters very well because, you know, Luke Cage wasn't talking with enough jive talk. So I wrote this scene where, like, he found out that Danny's girlfriend was having an affair with this vampire. It's a long story. And so he goes and he sees the guy, Tyrone King, this vampire guy, and he goes, "Look, man, you better leave her alone." Well, you know, and he's doing the whole, you know, Christmas thing, you know, the whole, you know, and it has no, the guy just ignores him. And Cage is walking out of the store, out of the restaurant where he met the guy, and he's thinking, well, okay, well, I tried my loud, angry Negro routine. That didn't work. You know, so I'll have to go some other way around. And the reaction was kind of like, I'm trying to explain to people that there's something called code switching. Mm-hmm. And when I'm home with my friends and so forth, I speak a different way. When I'm here, my nephew is sitting back there. When I'm talking to him, I'm talking in a different way because we're family and we have this relationship. For a person of color, particularly in an environment like Marvel, being able to articulate the English language is a job skill. There were times where I'm in an elevator, for instance. Like back in the 80s, Marvel was a lot like the TV show Mad Men. In fact, the season one of Mad Men, those offices looked almost exactly like Marvel's offices. It was very scary. But back in those times, there were times when I would get on the elevator and say a white woman would get on the elevator, a young white woman would get on the elevator, and I could clearly see she was uncomfortable. And I knew she would be uncomfortable until I started to speak. And I would say, make some joke, or I would talk to her about something, or I would just make some polite nonsense conversation, and I could see her visibly relax because it's like, oh, he's one of the good ones, you know. Oh, he's okay. And then my question, Reginald Hudlin, I told the story to Reginald Hudlin, he asked me, why was it your responsibility to make her feel comfortable? Which is a pretty good question. But I didn't make the rules. I didn't create the environment. I was glad just to be in those days at Marvel. I shouldn't tell you this, but I used to skip to work. I'd come out of the subway, and I would be so happy to be working. I can't believe I'm working at this place. I was 17 years old, you know, and I would start skipping down the store. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, the part of me that's relatively male would say, I'm skipping. Stop skipping now. You know. But I was so thrilled to be there. You know, so there was just a, you know, there's ways to conduct yourself. What I found in life is that, you know, and some fatherly advice that you didn't ask for, is figure out what you want and find a way to get paid to do it. Figure out what you love to do, find a way to get paid to do it. But in life in general, keep your eye on what you want and don't get distracted by the small stuff. So if there was racism, and there was, or just in office politics, and sometimes it was difficult to tell which was which, because did people not like me because I was black, or did they not like me because I was a jerk? And there were times when I was a jerk, and I spend a lot of time, and you read some of the stuff on my website where I'm apologizing for those days. I can't see that. The light's in right in there. Okay, gotcha. You know, so I'm loath to step back and go, well, there was a lot of racism, and that's why they, you know, whatever the story was. But my thing was, rather than me bellyaching about whatever my situation was, I said, I want to be here. I want to be successful. I'm going to take the hit. I'm going to do what I want to do. And you're going to have to work a lot harder than that to get me to leave. What did get me to leave Marvel, by the way, was they married Spider-Man. Somebody came to me and said, well, we think Spider-Man should get married. I think it was Shooter, Jim Shooter, or somebody came to me. And I was a Spider-Man editor at that time, the youngest guy to ever run the franchise, the blackest guy to ever run the franchise. And he comes and he goes, well, we're going to marry Spider-Man off. And I said, well, that's just really dumb. You know, and he goes, well, you know, blah, blah, we talked to Stan. Stan's on board. And he's a character that young people relate to. Once you get him married and he's, what are they doing now? You know, it's a great stunt, but what are you going to do after that? No, I said, look, Spider-Man gets married over my dead body. And hand to God, 4 weeks later, I was gone. And they brought a new editor, and Spider-Man got married, and they offered me the honeymoon issue, and gosh darn it, I wrote it. Because the money was, you know, that was it. All right, I got 15 minutes. Let's go. Sir?
I heard you were involved in the early setup of Milestone Comics.
Yes, I am Pete Best.
Can you talk about what you've done? I've heard your name referenced, but I don't really know.
I pretty much created all that stuff. We came together, we had a meeting, everybody brought something to the meeting. I brought what eventually became Icon and Rocket to the meeting. And I was better at naming things than some of the guys were. So I said, let's call this kid with the electric, let's call him Static, you know, and let's call this one this and let's call that one that. Dennis was doing character sketches right on the fly. It was a great time, and we were co-creating all that stuff. Dwayne McDuffie was involved at the time with some sort of custody dispute, and he was flying back and forth to Israel. So I wrote the first Bible, and then I was staying who is now the group editor, one of the group editors at DC, Jim Chadwick. I was in his office doing all the design work, the computer design work, and putting together proposals and all that other stuff like that. And what happened was at the last minute before they went to contract, there was a conflict between me. Not really even a conflict, but there was an issue between me and one of the partners. And I said, well, what I wanted to do was, I don't want to go into details, but I said, well, I wanted this situation to be addressed. And we couldn't resolve it, and so I stepped away. So I am the Pete Best of Milestone. We have a great relationship now. I am working with them. We are redeveloping the Milestone universe. We're doing Milestone 2.0. The creative stuff is being handled through Jim Lee and Reginald Hudlin. I'm meeting with them, with Reginald, on Sunday in L.A. The business end is being handled by Rip Van Winkle. I don't know what's going on with the business side. I don't do that. So there's a lot of creative in the pipeline, and I assume at some point the business end of it will work itself out. I created the logo for Milestone. Yes?
Yeah, I'm also a writer. I've read a series of books called Night Seeker.
Excellent.
I was writing my third book. I was dealing with a villain named the Guillotine. It actually is Ray Park. I told him about the most of the book as a villain. And when I got doing the villain, I was in a dark place, and I didn't know how to really break out of it. And it came out fantastic. And I had one of my readers, she's a criminal psychologist.
Yeah.
She went back and said, you know what? Everything you did for that villain, I would have done the same exact damn thing he did if I was in his shoes. And it kind of scared me that she wrote back and said that to me.
Wow.
And it kind of affected me a little bit. I said, what a damn good job. But at the same time, I didn't know I'd get that dark with it. And how do you get to your own little dark place, and how do you kind of break out of it when you go back into your regular world?
Well, getting in is easy. I got married. I think every writer is looking for truth. And what I mean by that is we're all trying to sort of, you know, reconcile or work out our inner demons or our little hang-ups or whatever. Virtually everything that happened, I wrote this an annual for a character called The Ray. And it was the only annual that they had. And the plot of the story was there's this jumbo jet that's crashing. And Ray tries everything he can, because he's seen Superman do it, so this must be easy. And he tries everything he can to keep that plane from crashing, and it crashes anyway. And that story was about my divorce. It was about my marriage. And how hard we tried. And, so that is, you know, we're couching it in metaphors of superheroes and villains and so forth, but... You know, we're working out stuff in our head. As far as getting in and out, when you get in, the magic is happening. And it might be dark magic in your case, but the ink is flowing right like hell, because when it stops flowing, it's hard as heck to figure out how to get it flowing again. I want to get you in real quick.
Comment and a question. I think it's pretty shitty that Marvel made the Falcon the so-called Black Captain America when he already had one. In my opinion, it's great, and I love his character.
Josiah, yeah.
Now, if he actually stayed on the book and carried on, what would happen?
Oh, man. I, if you give me your email address, I'll try to look at my note. Huh?
I emailed you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
if you do that, just remind me, and I'll have to look at my notes. That was a long time ago, but we had plans for him, and it was at the time very controversial to have him. What he's talking about is the Black Captain America. He was a Muslim American. And at the time, that was very like, ooh. And now, of course, one of our biggest selling books, right, as it stars a Muslim American as well. Yeah. Any other questions real quick? Yes.
What's your greatest unfulfilled ambition in comics? Is there a character you'd like to write or to create that you haven't been able to?
No, but I always wanted to write Batman for DC and Iron Man for Marvel. And I've worked for the editors of those books. And I was actually assigned to Batman... after I wrote the story that became part of Batman Begins, the rumor was like, oh, Denny's going to hire you, you're going to be the Batman writer, and then the scheduling department sent me my schedule, and you're late on your deadline, and blah, 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 and I said, nobody's called me and actually offered me the job yet. And what happened was, just before Denny picked up the phone, Marv Wolfman walked in the door, and he goes, hey, Denny, how you doing? You got anything, And Marv Wolfman was a name, and at the time I was, the Joan Rivers, pitching in there. He got bumped off the book. Now, ironically, I'm writing his book, so there's a sweet revenge. Red Hat.
You had said earlier that you never won anything. I'd say that you've earned that. You didn't win it. And also, can we look forward to any sort of common Woody-esque humor in Deadpool? Will anyone be standing in a urinal saying more than three shakes your plane?
Well, yeah, that's one of the things that's been missing or absent from Deathstroke is humor. To be fair, the Rebirth issue isn't funny until you read issue one and you realize, oh, that was really funny, because it's kind of hard to explain. Deathstroke himself is never funny, but I am a complete idiot and I can't help myself. So, yes, the humor will visit Deathstroke. And there are humorous characters and humorous situations, but and just people mocking Slade. Wintergreen mocks him endlessly, so we'll do that too. Sir,
you both have some great artists like the Ed Power Porter and Anthony Wright, Chris Cross.
Yeah.
You'd love to work with again.
Well, I'm working with Joe again. I'm very happy about that. I'd like to work with all of them again. Chris Cross, I think, is one of the most brilliant storytellers that I've ever worked with. An incredibly sweet guy, but yeah, I met Neil Adams today. Now, I've known who he is, of course. I worked with Larry Hama, who was one of his acolytes, hold up a card. How are we doing here on time? Okay. But I never actually met the man himself, and it would be great if I could get a story drawn by Neil Adams. But I believe me, I've worked with about everybody. John Romita Jr. was the key operator of the Xerox machine when I came there. He was one of the first people I met. He was so happy to see me. He goes, here you go, he was like 19 or something, I've worked with a lot. I've been very blessed in this business. I've worked with a lot of people, either as a writer, as an editor, or I was their lackey, or whatever the story was, but you name them, I've pretty much worked with them over the time. I've got time for what? Two questions, you think? Two questions. Zen.
Earlier at the outside, you mentioned that Emerald Dawn took you 18 months.
Why? Emerald Dawn number one took me 18 months because I was working with my friend who's, that was name escaping me, the editor of the book. It's in there somewhere. It took me 18 months to write it because basically I wasn't Keith Giffen. Okay, so the editor was used to working with Keith and did a lot of Keith's most famous stuff. And Keith is just a fabulous writer. He's hilarious. I was not Keith Giffen. I was the guy writing Action Comics Weekly and got promoted to do this rebirth of Green Lantern. So He had me rewrite it about, 137 times or something. And finally, it occurred to me that, you know, I'm behind on my bills and things are getting cut off and stuff. And, you know, have you ever been on a job where you're working a job and you go, well, I have a job. And then you realize, no, I really don't have a job. I'm rewriting the same story 137 times. And I called him and said, call Keith. And that's what he did. He called Keith, and Keith took over from me, and they did a fabulous job. One.
Andrew Galther, Kevin.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Andy. Andy was the guy. And Andy, see, when you're working with a friend, Andy and I were good friends because we were both on staff at DC. It's awfully hard to go, you stink, you're fired. You know, so that's all I'm going to do. Last question, because people are coming in and they're wondering who I am. So, anything else? I'm sorry? Who's got the question? I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. Oh, there we go.
My question is on the shift from heroes to villains. It seems to have happened quite recently. I was just thinking that more and more villains stories should be told.
I really don't have any because I've been out of the loop from comics for so long that every time someone starts talking about she's in the Suicide Squad. She's kind of crazy. What's her name?
Harlequin,
right. I went, who's Harlequin? You know, and apparently she's very popular. I did not know that. There's some Harlequins here today, here in the convention. So I really wasn't following comics so much, but I think it's more like, you know, why is gangster rap popular? Why are vampires popular? You know, it's like, nobody wants to write good things. I want to do a book that's targeted for the Christian community. I want to do something through a Christian publisher. DC and or Marvel should be trying to reach that market. It's a multi-billion with a B dollar market. Why aren't we in it? I'm an ordained pastor. I know a lot of Christians who would love to do stuff like this. And I don't mean proselytizing. I don't mean Superman fights Jesus. You know, if you've ever seen the show Joan of Arcadia, they found the sweet spot where they could talk about spirituality without being overly pushy in one direction or another. And I think a lot of churches are preaching against what we do because there's too much skin, there's too much cussing, there's too much violence, and that's why you should all buy Deathstroke and my time is up. Thank you.